posted yesterday in terms of the format, so anybody who wants to know about that, keep your ears tuned for later today. Okay, so I think what we'll start with our agenda today is we have a number of topics still left. We have our Yom Tovim topics that we spoke about, which actually there were quite a few. And then, overall on our agenda, so in terms of Shabbos, even if we don't count the stuff that we did very recently, we have Shneim Shaso and Electricity and Refuah and Lush. So we'll try to squeeze everything in. So I think we'll start now, let's say for today's session, at least for this session right now, with some of the Yom Tovim topics. And I don't expect to be able to chazer every detail, so what I'll try to do is just give as broad an overview as possible so we can get in as much as possible. So to go in order, we spoke about, first let's say Purim was the first narrative that we spoke about, and we spoke about Shalach Manas. And when it comes to Shalach Manas, so we noted that there are two major opinions as to what Shalach Manas is meant to accomplish. That Shalach Manas as a din de Rabbanan, but one that has perhaps a more chumer status because it's conveyed to us through a pasuk, and we have a notion of Dirai Kabbalah, that if something is in scripture, meaning it's in psukim, but it's not in chumash itself, so we call that Dirai Kabbalah. And some of the Achronim, most prominently led by the Shagas Aryeh in his Turi Aven, asserted that we treat Dirai Kabbalah like Dirai Torah. Based on a line in the Gemara and Rosh Hashanah and Daf Yud Ches, so that line is really in a very specific context, but many did accept the Turi Evans Chiddush that by all Divrei Kabbalah we treat L'chumra, so therefore Shalach Manas is maybe treated like a Din Daraisa, even though it's really an origin as an institution of Chazal. And there was some discussion as to what is the purpose of Shalach Manas. Why did they institute this din? And the whole discussion really got kicked off by a psak of the Rama that the Chassam Sofer discussed in the Tshuva, that the Rama said that if I offer Shalach Manas to someone and the person I offer it to says, thank you so much, it's a wonderful thought, but I don't need it, so the Rama says, you're Yotzei. That's the fulfillment of Shalach Manas. And many others found this very surprising. Pri Chadash and many others thought that was hard to believe, because the pasuk says mishloach manos, doesn't say offering manos. Why should it be true that you can get off that easy? And even though we know it's sometimes true, there is the concept of mechila in halacha, and we know that sometimes that might mean that if I owe you $10 and you say it's alright, I'm mochel, so that could mean that you view it as if you received the $10 and that you have the power to do that. Okay, so we know sometimes that works, but how do we know that that's the mechanism here? That only works if the recipient is in control of the situation, so it's a monetary debt to him. So then he has the right to say, I consider it as if it was done. But how do we know that that's the same relevant mechanism here? So this was a big question, and the Chassam Sofer essentially thought that it was totally on two different ways you could understand Shalach Manas. And he dug up that this was a machlokas, the earlier svar. On the one hand, you have the Truma Sadeshin. The Truma Sadeshin seems to say the purpose of Shalach Manas is to help out with another mitzvah of Purim, that being the mitzvah of Suda. That since people need to have a Suda on Purim, so therefore you have to make sure to send around enough food so that people can eat with their, people can have what to eat for the Suda. And that's why we have such a Takan. And the Manos Salevi, which was written by the author of L'cha Dodi, Rav Shlomo Alkabetz, so he had a different spin on it, and he understood that the purpose was that we want to be Marbe Shalom Bereis. It's to counteract what Halman said about the Jews, that they are scattered and dispersed. So we want to show that's not the case, that we are able to be bonded together through food, through that most beautiful of unifying agents. And the Chassam Sofer asserted this was a machlokas between the two of them, and therefore the question of whether you could be mochel or not should depend, because if it's like the Manos HaLevi said, that we're trying to make friends, so So then it's really the thought that counts. If you tell me, thanks for offering, but I can't take it, I don't need to take it. So then, okay, so then that should be enough. But if it's about helping people out with the Suda, it's kind of a stucca type of institution. So then it doesn't make sense that we would allow Mechila, because if we would, so then everyone's going to be embarrassed to take it. And people who really need it are not going to actually get it. And in the event that somebody would be mochel, so then people could also get off very easy. They'll just offer it to all their rich friends. And that way, they'll basically negate the whole institution of Shalach Manos. So it doesn't make sense to say that if that was the purpose, that they would include Mechila as a possibility. That's what the Chassam Sofer said. And he thought it was totally on this issue. So, if you stop here, you already get the basic thrust to this discussion, because we mentioned in this context that it was quite impressive the way the Chassam Sofer really set the trend here. That every discussion ever since the past 250 years, let's say, every discussion that talks about Shalach Manos has always assumed that the, whatever issue it is you're talking about is somehow connected to the Manos Halevi and the Trumas Hadeshim. So if you're going to say, should I give my Shalach Manos in a red basket or in a blue basket? So then the response you get will be, well, it's probably dependent on the Manos Halevi and the Trumas Hadeshim, that if it's about making friends, so then, you know, blue is cheerier, and if it's about the Suda, so then red fits better with your silverware. Somehow every issue that you could have will somehow be connected to this issue. There was one detractor in the time of the Chassam Sofer, the Shuvas Chalkas Asada, Priyasada, the same Chaver as the Sefer, Priyasada, Chalkas Asada, Reza Deutsch. So he thought the whole thing was overblown, that it's not really a machlokas. But they're saying the same thing. They both agree the purpose of Shalach Manos is to make friends. Just happens to be that the Trumas Hadeshim says, the Dover Beito Matov, if you want to make friends, so you're better off giving a gift that's very relevant to what they need at the moment. So since they need to have a Suda, so then food would be the appropriate type of gift. But essentially it's the same thing as the Manos Halevi said. I think I mentioned that Rabbi Simon, when they wrote about this once, he wrote me a letter saying how much he appreciated the publicizing of that point, because he also thinks this whole machlokas has been kind of taken a little bit beyond where it needs to be. I mean, it's more of a machlokas, less of a machlokas than it has been portrayed, but in any event, this is the common understanding that there is a machlokas on these two points, and that any issue that comes up in Shalach Manos somehow connects to this. So we'll just try to quickly, in the interest of time, touch on what some of those points are without going into too much detail. So one point that the Chassam Sofer himself throws into the conversation is the question of whether a single woman, or rather a married woman, let's say, should have to give Shalach Manos. Let's say if a married woman is somech al shulchan baila, that she is supported by her husband, so then she's not paying for her own meals, so she's obligated to pay for somebody else's meals. So the Rama says that a woman is obligated in Shalach Manos, and that was also a controversial psak, because one could argue that if she's not paying for her own meals, she's not mechuyev to pay for other people's meals. So the Chassam Sofer says, it's also totally, so you could have said, he quotes from some svarim, they could have said, well, maybe the Rama's only talking about a single woman, but a married woman is not obligated. But l'shitaso, according to the Rama, it makes sense either way, that if it's about making friends, so that everybody's mechuyev, and then women, even if they're married women, are mechuyev also, or anybody else who's somech al shulchan acherim, is still chayev in Shalach Manos. One of the major issues that once upon a time I thought was the one issue that's not totally at all until I saw that here as well, that those who connect this, has to do with a question the Achronim wanted to suggest, and mostly the Binyan Sion and a few others, that based on Iran, that maybe we should have a Chumrah, that you should davka have to have a Shliach for Shalach Manos, that you shouldn't do it on your own, but that you should have somebody else do it. So the whole question, why that would be, and it's unlikely that that's a real din, because really, it doesn't make sense that we should have a din which can only be fulfilled through shlichus. Usually we have a rule that anything you can't do yourself, you can't do through shlichus either. So to say that shlichus is a requirement, it's really not something we find anywhere else in halacha, and is hard to assume would be true. It happens to be the case that, as the Dvar Rav and others explain, that here, we're not talking about normal shlichus in the sense of shlucho shladam kamoso, We're talking about having an emissary. We're talking about sending it with a messenger. Not that this person has the halachic status of you. And the person could be any intermediary. It could be somebody who's not a bar shlichus. It could be somebody who's a cotton, somebody who's not Jewish, and the like. It's not halachic shlichus in the normal sense. So it's really kind of outside of that conversation. But in any event, it doesn't seem like this chumra is really accepted as an actual din. And it seems like, according to either reasoning, it shouldn't be necessary. Either way, you're going to help with the suda or make friends if you give it directly or if you give it with a shliach. So, then I saw the Satmar Rav has in his chuvis that he thought that maybe if it's about making friends, and then using a shliach makes it drop more sense. And maybe we could understand a little bit better why that would be. Because if you're trying to make friends, then you want to show that this is something that you thought of beforehand. This is not something that just popped into your head as you walked into the street and you met him while you're walking. So since if you're going to use a messenger, you can only do that if you have a lot of planning and forethought. So when they receive the Shalach Manas to a messenger, then they know that they have gotten it intentionally, and maybe that's the idea that it has a greater effect towards Shalom Bereis in that case. You can certainly argue on that approach. Hi.
Maybe it could also be that if you're antagonistic with this guy and trying to reconcile, so doing it with Shliach might be more
effective, if that's the case. Right. So in a situation where, if we're assuming that when we say Shalom Bereis, we mean Davka people who you have tension with, so then maybe more understandable why you would pursue it through a third party. Could be. This is also relevant to the concern of when the Shalach Manas gets there. The Ramah is makbid that the Shalach Manas has to get there not only on Purim, but also that Purim is unique among the Yom Tovim, that the mitzvahs are really during the day specifically. So that's what the Ramah says, it has to get there during the day and not the night before. And the truth is, it could have made a big case that it could get there the night before, certainly, and maybe even the day before, because if it's there for the purposes of the Suda, so then let it get there in time for you to eat on Purim. What difference does it make whether it got there the day earlier or not, as long as it's something that will keep that long? So it seems that the Ramah is l'shitaso, that the Ramah believes that it's about making friends. So how do you make friends with Shalach Manas? What's the key in Hamitzvah, so to speak? That's the... Oh, isn't that nice moment? Right, when do they say, oh, isn't that nice? They say that when they receive it. So since that's the case, so then you have to actually have that moment, the oh, isn't that nice moment, on Purim itself in order to make friends with Shalach Manas. We then discussed, see what else did we mention before. There's also impacts on other issues in terms of timing. We mentioned also that the Kajgul of Arav, Kedakar B'Kodesh, was creatively Mulamed Tzchus on Klal Yisrael. So why is it that you see sometimes people who are running around delivering Shalach Manas even after dark, even when it's technically Shushan Purim at that point? So he suggested that since we have an approach which seems to be widely accepted, that the Suda of Purim can continue into after Purim as long as it starts on Purim. So then that's still called the Suda of Purim. So therefore, if anyone helps with that Suda, it would still be helping with the Suda's Purim, according to the Trimus Hadesha, even if it's after Purim has technically ended. It's an interesting limit stress. We also mentioned that there was a suffix about whether you could give to a cotton or not. And, yes, sir?
That would go against the
Ramah. That would go, right, to the Trimus Hadesha, which is different than the Ramah.
Meaning the Ramah said you can't do that.
Correct. And the Ramah would also say you can't give it earlier either. It's got to be specifically during the daytime of Purim. Both not earlier or later. And we would assume that if for the purpose of the Suda, we would certainly allow it a little bit earlier, enough, as long as it's close enough that it shouldn't spoil. And here the Kajib Lever is saying, and finish on the other end, that it could even go a little bit afterwards if the Suda is still going on.
I'm sure Buster would appreciate getting it earlier.
Probably true, yes. In terms of preference, he probably would. She mentioned a few others. Vegas, there's also a suffix about whether you can give to a cotton or not. So here, everyone agrees, apparently, that I've seen that this is totally on the Trumas Hadesh and Amanda Salevi, because they are obligated by Menik Yisrael to assume all issues are totally on that. But there's an interesting difference in terms of which way is it totally. Is that you find lack of agreement on. So some svarim that say that if it's about making friends, so then you can make friends with the katan too, but if it's about helping with the suda, so the katan is not obligated to the suda. While there are those who say the exact opposite. If it's about making friends, so presumably you make friends with somebody of your own age group. But if it's about helping with the suda, so the whole family is obligated to the suda. So that shows you something about the malleability of the Hakira, but also about the consistent devotion all svarim have to talking about all the issues through the prism of this question, whichever direction it takes you in. We also saw the question of Ksav Sofer, who certainly could be justified in following the path of some Sofer, else like he would have. So he talks about the question of, again, we wouldn't recommend this today in a modern context, but anonymous Shalachmanis, if you're going to leave an unmarked box outside somebody's house, it's probably not going to work so well today. But once upon a time, it was less problematic to do that in a simpler era. So are you Yotzei Shalach Manas? Here it's interesting. So this, you could really argue, could go in opposite directions. Because if it's about staka, so then we know that the Rambam says that anonymously giving staka is a higher level of staka. But if it's about making friends, so then this is a little bit the weaker half of the equation, but you could argue that you can't make friends if they don't know who you are. Now, you could counter that by saying, but even better, it'll be friends with all the Klal Yisrael, because they'll just feel this general fuzzy sense of warmth towards people. But okay, that tends not to work so well. You need to have some focused target of your appreciation, so maybe that's indeed the case, and that's how Ksav Sofer has suggested on this front. I talked also about the question of qualitative appreciation, that we know that there is, in terms of a shear for Shalach Manas, so we know we talk about two items to one person, but what about the worth of each item, or the worth of the total package even? So there was a machlokus whether to evaluate that based on hana, I'll say shavakruta, or based on its food usability, eatability, in terms of a kezias. But it's also interesting, there's a subjective element also that the Ritva maintains. The Ritva in Megillah on Daf Zayin, that if you are giving a davar katan le'ashir, or a davar katan me'ashir, that if you're going to give a very wealthy person a small gift, or you are going to get a small gift from a very wealthy person, so then perhaps you're not going to be too impressed by that, and therefore maybe if we follow the Trumas HaDeshen, that's workable, but if you follow the Manos HaLevi, then you're not going to be so impressed by the person because it's not something that registers, either because you're too rich for it or you recognize that the giver is capable of much more.
Hi. Just in the case of the Gemara,
which case in the Gemara? The Gemara,
I think it was like Rabba sent to buy like peppers or something, even though he was a big king or something.
So that is the Ritva commenting on that line. I remember I thought it was commenting on the brothers who traded. You could be right, I have to look at it again if it's commenting on that line specifically. But not to see exactly how it connects to the Gemara, but that was what he pointed out, that he thought that a good davar katan le'asher and me'asher is not going to register. So Ritva is quoted a lot in various other shilas. So for example, Rav Zolti has a piece about why is it that we say that, or not necessarily why, with the question of whether we should be kofa on Shalach Manas, which also is a question that goes in both directions. Should we enforce Shalach Manas? So if it's about Suda, and Staka for the Suda, so we do know that there is such an institution sometimes of Kofen al Staka, that sometimes common al Stakas are enforced by Kvezdas. But if it's a situation of trying to make friends, so you can imagine the guy shows up at the door with two U.S. Marshals saying, hi, I'm obligated by force of Bezdin to give you this gift, so you're not going to be incredibly impressed by his sense of generosity. This is also invoked in the context of if somebody gives you a gift that you know that it's worthless to them. Like, for example, this sounds like an outlandish case, but a number of postmen talk about this specific case. So let's say you're a chalila, and you are able to therefore eat something that is asur b'hanam midrabban. So the person who gives it to you is a person who has something that's asur b'hanam midrabban, so he can't eat it, so he'll give it to you, you're the chola. So you're not going to be incredibly impressed by this, you'll be happy to get it maybe because it's extra food, but so it'll help you with the suda, but it's not going to necessarily impress you as far as generosity, so that may also depend. The Gemara makes clear in Chulin that by Gnevas Das, the Gnevas Das, so the Gemara clearly states there that people are generally less grateful to you for things that they know you can't use. So if you give something that's valuable to yourself, so then the recipient appreciates it even more. If you give them something that you can't use, okay, so then better than throwing it out, but they're not going to be too impressed if they know that it's something that you can't use yourself. So maybe a few other issues we talked about. We talked about the question of why there's no bracha. So the most famous reason given in general why mitzvahs don't get a bracha when it's relevant is the Tshuvas HaRashba. The Rashba says you don't give a bracha, you don't give a bracha on tzedakah. It sounds like his concern is, even though there's some discussion if this is what he meant or not, but it sounds like his concern is that maybe the recipient will say no. And therefore, maybe you'll be left hanging, like the famous joke with the guy who was about to get killed. And so,
and his 10 sons?
No, the guy is about to, Brusker, who's about to get killed by an Arab in Israel. So he makes a bracha of Al Kiddush Hashem, and then the guy gets freaked out and runs away. So then the Brusker chases after him and goes, "You want to be left hanging with bracha of Atala?" So that sounds like the Rashba's concern that he's afraid. That the has the joke sauce is afraid that the recipient won't accept it, so therefore that's a problem. So they point out that this svara is not going to work here because according to the Ramah, even if the recipient doesn't accept it, you still yosei. So then you're not really telling any of the other guys receiving it or not. So then they turn sometimes to the second most famous explanation, which is the Beis Yosef. The Beis Yosef in Hilchos Pesach says when it comes to bittul chametz, the reason we make the bracha on beer chametz instead of bittul chametz is because bittul is belayed, and we don't make a bracha on things that are belayed. So therefore, if the kiyum is really the shalom bereis, maybe that's belayed, so then maybe that's why there's no bracha on that. It could be. Others suggest different things. Among the other suggestions that we find, this Rudy H points out that along the lines of what we said a few minutes ago about the U.S. Marshals, that the idea is you're trying to make friends, so it's not going to be so impressive if you come to somebody's house and say, "Listen, I got a gift for you. Hold on 1 second. Thank you, O God, who forced me and commanded me and ordered me and compelled me to give this gift." It's going to also perhaps ruin the moment, so to speak. So maybe that's another concern. Or somewhat similarly, the Das Sofer, also a descendant of the Chassam Sofer, suggests that if the Trumas Hadeshim is right, so essentially, the Das Sofer, that if the Trumas Hadeshin is right, so then essentially what you have here is really Matanas Lev Yonim and Shalach Manas are really the same thing. They're really both about the same idea. They're about supplying for the needy on Purim. It's just that Matanas Lev Yonim is the overt monetary tzedakah, and Shalach Manas is kind of a disguised tzedakah, which is dressed up as food and given as a neighborly kind of thing, but really it's also a form of tzedakah. So therefore, what we're really doing is kind of merging those two into one. So we don't want to make a bracha, which the bracha is going to have to identify which mitzvah it is by its very nature. So therefore, maybe it doesn't make sense to have a bracha for this mitzvah. And we also mentioned that there were some discussions that some thought were maybe a Purim joke, a question of whether you could be yotzei with Divrei Torah, because Divrei Torah, you know, in some contexts, is considered like food. This comes up to Zohar's comment about Erev Pesach Shechalios B'Shabbos, maybe having Shal Shudas through Divrei Torah instead. A famous line that Reb Chaim responded to that. They thought that Shal Shudas through food was a bad idea, Shal Shudas through Divrei Torah was a bad idea because maybe somebody will shlug up the Divrei Torah and you'll be left with nothing. Well, it's hard to slug up with a filter fish, you supposedly said. So you could view it as food, or you could say it doesn't have to be viewed as food, that maybe if the whole idea is to create friendship, so then this also creates a bond of friendship, and this should be acceptable as well. And it's interesting that we've said so far that the Ramah and the Manos Halevi are in the same camp here, in terms of seeing it as Shalom Vareis. So they both seem to have done this, to have written Svarim that they gave out as Shalach Manas. The Manas Halevi wrote the Sefer Manas Halevi as Shalach Manas. And the Ramah also has a Sefer that he apparently gave out for that purpose called Mechir Yayin, that was also meant to accomplish that. So that maybe would be L'shitasam. I think that was most of what we talked about. That we probably just ended by talking about the vort that the Menachem Zemba has.
That's the Yotzi
Shalt with the Torah. So it's not necessarily that they say it, but that it may flow from the Shita, and reportedly they both did it. So I don't know if they necessarily put it in writing that you could do it, but it seems to have been their practice, which would be consistent with their Shita. And then we probably ended by noting the vort that Menachem Zemba has. Menachem Zemba, who we quote occasionally in the context of Hilchos Shabbos, because he wrote the Sefer Tzotzos Chaim, where, but he says elsewhere that there is a, you know, the Gemara and Megillah on Daf Yudalei, the Gemara raises the question about what did the Jews do that they deserved to be threatened with death in the time of Achashverosh, and the Gemara has two possible answers: either Mipnei Shenenu Misudaso Shalosha Rasha, because they partook in the Suda of Achashverosh, which was, even though it was actually kosher food, but it was clearly a very inappropriate Suda, or because Shenishtach of Ulitzalim, that they kind of bowed down to a bit of Zara in terms of Haman's necklace, so to speak. So he suggests that it could correlate, the two reasons for Shalach Manas correlate to the reasons for the threat at that time, that if the issue was that they had an inappropriate Suda, so then the tikkun for that, the repair, would be the appropriate Suda of Suda's Purim, so therefore we're focused on trying to help with that. If the idea was that they were engaged in Avodah Zarah, so then the Medrash says that Shalom is such a powerful force that Kadosh Baruch Hu declares Bizman Shehem Bechabura Achat Afilu Avdu Avodah Zarah Nimokulahem, that even if they're involved in Avodah Zarah, I will be mochel them if they make one Aguda, if they make Shalom. So perhaps that's the imagery that is suggested there. So that's what he wanted to suggest, that these two ideas could be paralleled in the two reasons for the threat of the time of Purim. Okay, so that's enough of a recap of that subject. Any questions on any of that? Was that clear? Any issues? Okay. Moving on, so another thing we did talk about when Purim time is we talked a little bit about Purim spiels and Hilchos Lashon Hara. So that getting into that whole discussion, just trying to say some key points about it, especially it's relevant to the past 2 weeks' parshiyos. So there, just a key point that we mentioned is, and we probably got into this in a lot more detail, but I'm going to have to focus, just let's say, on this one significant point, is that there is a big controversy about the propriety of Purim spiels and Purim Torah. They are widely spread minhagim, but understandably there are those who object to both. In terms of Purim Torah, the potential bizayin haTorah, and in terms of Purim spiels, so there is that, and there's also a potential Habanus Pnei Chaver Barabim and Lashon Hara and the like, so we can certainly see why many poskim would be wary about it. However, again, it is a widespread custom, and in our yeshiva we certainly have the custom of having both. And as Rav Schechter has pointed out in other contexts, our yeshiva was founded by people who came over from Balazhin, and that's why everything we do is exactly like they did in Volozhin. And so in Volozhin, it is recorded, they certainly did have these practices. That is recorded in history books and elsewhere, both in terms of the Purim Torah, certainly, and in terms of Purim Spiels as well. I think I mentioned the story that in the days of the Netziv, there was a Talmud who did a perfect imitation of the Netziv. His name was Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Cook. And he grew up, of course, to be much more famous and to have his own yeshiva, Merkas HaRav, and there the top Talmud was a great-grandson of the Netziv who did a perfect imitation of Rav Cook. And Rav Cook said, okay, I've been paid back, but that was the minig. So clearly, in some yeshivas, it was certainly accepted. So, and others as well. So, how do we address this issue? So, in terms of the concerns of, let's say, Lashon Hara and Habanas Panim, etc. So first of all, the straightforward point is that we have to be very, very careful. We have to make sure all of these productions are done under rabbinic supervision by people who have good judgment and who are aware of people's pages and the like, and it's not something that can be easily undertaken without any care. But that being said, also, just to address a specific halachic point about it, so what about the issue of, let's say, Lashon Hara? So certainly, to actually embarrass people, if they really are going to be embarrassed, is a tremendous isser, a very significant isser. Next year, God willing, Maseches Bava Metzia, it's a topic that appears in that Masechta at length. But, and so if that's a possibility, for sure, that's a tremendous avera, and we should also assume Safek L'chumra, that you don't want to even risk embarrassing someone. But even on a lower level, so what about Lashon Hara? So should we assume that there is a concern of Lashon Hara? So maybe you'll say, well, Lashon Hara, you're just joking around. So does that help? So not really, because Lashon Hara, there are schok, so both the Rambam and the Chafetz Chaim agree that that's aser. According to the Rambam, it's avak Lashon Hara. According to the Chafetz Chaim, it's mamash Lashon Hara. So that doesn't seem to help that much, the fact that it's derech schok. I should point out in general that bullies will often invoke that they are doing something as a joke. That's even less of a defense. When it comes to Lashon Hara, it's easier to maintain that maybe derech schok should be a defense, because if what you're saying bad about someone, if you don't mean it seriously, okay, so taka, that is a little bit of a mitigating factor. It does take out the sting a little bit. But if you're beating somebody up and you say it was a joke, so that just makes you a sadist. That doesn't really, because the joke is not shared by both parties. It's only funny for the guy doing the beating. So there's really no defense in that at all. So for most contexts where the derech schok attempt is invoked, is really not at all helpful. In the context of Lashon Hara, you could hear a case why maybe it should be helpful, but still you don't find it brought that way in the Rambam and the Chafetz Chaim. So that's probably not the answer. So what is the answer? So you might say, well, it's Mechila. So Mechila would help a little bit, but that's also questionable if Mechila really works here. We do find Mechila invoked in the context of Rishonim invoke it, in the context of Simchas Purim and other such occasions, but in a monetary context. So if somebody creates small hezek to property because of a Purim celebration, or certainly minor or certain minor genevos. So there is an approach in Rishonim, in Sukkah and Daf Mem Hey, and elsewhere, that there is a implicit mechila that people should be able to celebrate Purim uninhibited. So there is such a svar. But does that work for this? It's not clear that it works, because maybe mechila only works for monetary issues. So, okay, you don't have to pay me for the carpet. You stole stuff on my carpet. You don't have to pay me for that. And when I grab my stuff, I'm muffled. But if it's personal suffering, so then it's not clear that mechila works. What does that mean, mechila doesn't work? It doesn't mean that the person doesn't have control over whether he'll allow it or not. It means that it never sticks, that the person could always change his mind, because the assumption is that personal suffering accumulates and that somebody may be muffled at one point, but then can't take it anymore. So they're never bound, they're never committed to their mechila, because Tzar HaGuf, many Rishonim understand, is not subject to that kind of mechila. Hi.
Didn't we learn in the Kippur HaBrios, that monetary issues aren't universal?
That monetary, in Kippur HaBrios, we saw that monetary issues was a case where Kippur HaBrios wins. So the person was mochel specifically on monetary rights in that case. The example there was that the person decided that he's willing to not have his property returned in order to protect the dignity of the individual who found it. So that works in that context. And specifically also, it's a monetary right, so I have the right to get my property back, I'm mechila on the property. But here we're talking about whether mechila works for a personal suffering. So you want to beat me up, I'm mechila. So that mechila, you can never tell me that I'm committed to that mechila, because I can't take it anymore. I have the right to go back on it. That mechila is not considered to be a binding mechila. So it's not clear in this case, if you're making fun of somebody and say, well, he's mochel. So yes, logically it's true, the person does have a right to determine what bothers him and what doesn't bother him. But it's a risky kind of mechila, because they could always change their mind, and the halacha would recognize their changing their mind more than it will their original mechila. So that's a problematic svara. So it's probably not based on mechila either. What I think it is based on is something else, which I think we strive for certainly here, is that in Hilchos Lashon Hara, so this is a major, major sugya. I'm just going to allude to it. When we originally talked about it, we only alluded to it briefly in order to make this point, and we'll do that again without going into all the details of it. But we know there is a concept in Hilchos Lashon Hara called Apei Tlasa, that if something is said in front of three, so then that's not subject to the laws of Lashon Hara. And it's a big discussion what that means. There are at least four different views in the Rishonim, whether that means that the original Lashon Hara was heard by more than three people, so therefore the listeners can assume that it's already public knowledge, so they're not violating anything further by spreading it, or maybe it only applies under certain circumstances in that case. But there are other Rishonim who maintain that it's not just a heter for the listeners, but it's a heter for the speaker, that the speaker is allowed to say something if more than three people are there. So why should that be? You would think that, if anything, that makes it a much bigger aveir. Why should it help that there are more than one person there? That makes it worse. And in fact, that's sort of what the Chafetz Chaim says, right? If you speak Lashon Hara in front of one person, it's bad. More people, that's much worse, probably exponentially worse, because it geometrically increases how many people find out about it. So what in the world does that sheet mean? So Tosfos seems to suggest that it correlates to another surprising statement in the Talmud. And the Talmud also has a statement that if you say something in somebody's presence, then it's not Lashon Hara. And once again, you could say, what do you mean it's not Lashon Hara? It's both. That's Lashon Hara and Halbanos Pnei Chaver Barabbas. Then you're also embarrassing the person. So why should that be mutter? That should be worse. And again, that's what the Chafetz Chaim says. Is that if you say something behind someone's back, it's bad. If you say it in front of them, it's even worse. So what does it mean to say, if you say it in public or you say it in front of the person, that all of a sudden it becomes mutter? Very hard to understand. So the way Tosfos seems to understand it, Tosfos and Erech and Tosfos and Bovasser seem to understand that it works the following way. That we're not talking about something which is genuinely negative. If you're going to say something that's really disparaging, so for sure it's worse if you say it to more people, it's worse if you say it in front of the person. That's a given. The question is, we're talking about something, according to Tosfos, we're talking about something that's really kind of in between. That it's somewhat ambiguous, and it could be interpreted by the listener as either positive or negative. Like we gave an example at the time, if I'm going to say, oh, that Pliny, you can always count on him. So I could mean it positively, he's very reliable. Or I could mean it negatively, that you can always count on him to mess up. So how do we know? Maybe we should say that the speaker shouldn't say such a thing, because if the listener is not going to know how to interpret it, maybe we have to worry, they'll interpret it negatively. So it's not right to say something which could be interpreted negatively. That's connected to what we call avak lashon hara sometimes. So to that, Tosfos is addressing that, yes, so really you shouldn't say something that might be interpreted negatively, even though it could go both ways. But if you say it in public, or if you say it in front of the person, so then, if you're a decent person, and the question of how much the internet may have changed this nowadays, which is a very serious subject, which really wasn't what we focused on, but if you're a decent person, so chances are, if the person is there in the room, or if there are many people there, so it's going to get around, so then you're going to mean it the positive way. So with my example before about, oh, you can count on him. So all right, so you don't know what that means. If I'm going to whisper it to you in the corner, you're not sure whether I made it positively or negatively. But if I get up at the shul dinner and I say, oh, Plony, you can count on him, so then hopefully I'm a decent guy. Hopefully what I mean is that you should take it positively. And since he's there and so many other people are there also, so then that's the way it should be interpreted by the crowd and it would be permissible to say. So I think that this is the active element here. So when it comes to the Purim spiels, if they're done right, and that's what we strive for here, so then the understanding that's created is that it's a context of affection rather than bizayin. And the fact that the people generally, are the people who are portrayed, are for the most part, if not all of them, but as they could be, are sitting there laughing and enjoying it. So that's relevant. why is it relevant? Not because of the mechila, even though that's semi-relevant, but we said a few minutes ago, mechila is not going to help that much. But it's also an indication of the fact that this is not something that's really considered disparaging. If it was so disparaging, so then the people probably wouldn't be sitting there laughing, having a good time, and the performers wouldn't be comfortable doing it in front of them. So the atmosphere that's created is hopefully an atmosphere of love and affection in the Purim context rather than a desire, and that's what we strive for, and that's what I think is reflected in terms of this Hilchos Lashon Hara. I should also point out, just in terms of, you know, again, what to be balancing off of, so the fact the person is there and present, like we said, mechila is not necessarily enough to rely on. Also, there were some poskim who mentioned, when they talk about their opposition to shpils and the like, is they think people just laugh because they feel they're under social pressure to laugh and that they're going to look worse if they don't laugh, but really inside they are crying and suffering and they're miserable. So if that is indeed the case, so then certainly that's something to be very worried about. I think, again, I hope that it's a situation that at least here in Yeshiva has always been successful, that the people are genuinely laughing and are genuinely okay with what's going on. And again, it takes a little bit of judgment and experience and rabbinic supervision to make sure that that's what we're talking about, so that the people don't misjudge this situation, which obviously is a big risk as well. Okay, so I think that was most of what we said about that specific point. I'll probably get into a little bit more. I think we talked about it for a long time, but I think that's the key point that I wanted to draw out of that discussion. Any questions about any of that? Make sense? Okay, so we'll probably leave the rest for our 1 o'clock slides. So just in terms of Yom Tov, what else do we talk about? So yesterday we talked about Sfiras Omer, so we're not going to chazer that now because we talked about it yesterday. And again, in terms of the details of the format and how scared you shouldn't be, you should not be daunted to explain why in more detail. One, just in the interest of not saying it many times, but the other two Yontif topics, if I remember correctly, that we spoke about were Dalet Kosos and Mechiras Chametz. Right, so those are, Mechiras Chametz especially was a massive topic, took us 2 full days of shiur. We're not going to spend that much time chazering again. We'll speak quickly, we'll just try to highlight some of the key points and some of the key points of Dalet Kosos as well. And we'll try to do that at 1 o'clock, and then we still have a little bit more to try to squeeze in over the next 2 days after that. Okay, so everybody's good otherwise? Any questions, any issues, any problems, any complaints, any criticisms, any attacks, any testimonials, any soliloquies, any diatribes, rants? Okay, so I think we've covered all the possible categories of what you could be doing. So then we'll head back to the base magic now, and we'll meet back here at 1. Yeshikoach, how are you? Yes, sir. So you got my email?
I did.
Okay.
I still know what I did, so...